Well, hey there, come on in. We're just about to start. Welcome to My Wife the Dietitian, a fun weekly podcast about nutrition and healthy lifestyle. I'm Rob, and together with my wife Sandra, we invite you to join us on this informative and entertaining journey through the complex world of healthy eating.
Join us each week as we strive to help you with transforming your overall health and relationship with food through up-to-date, evidence-based nutrition information. As the rates of eating disorders, including binging behavior, skyrocket, we thought it would be a sensitive but timely topic to cover. We were able to interview an expert in eating disorders and a pioneer in the dietetics field, Shauna Melbourne, dietitian and eating disorder specialist.
I'm thankful for the show to be able to answer listeners' questions like this. I think if we went on Dr. Google, we would find all kinds of answers, but answers that a lot of them, unfortunately, could be rooted in diet culture and fat phobia and foodism, which leaves people feeling even more afraid of what is happening and not as helpful as what it could be.
Stay with us for this deep dive into eating disorders.
Enjoying the show? You can help others find it and enjoy it too by giving us a 5-star rating or review. If you feel like reaching out to us with a question or comment, you can send us an email at mywifetherd@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit our website at mywifethedietitian.com, as well as our social media pages. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Enjoy the show. Welcome to My Wife the Dietitian. Hello, Sandra.
Hey, Rob.
How's it going?
Good. I'm so thrilled today we get to talk to Shauna Melbourne.
Yes, Shauna.
Dietitian. She's an eating disorder specialist. And I've been following Shauna's career for 20 years as she's an eating disorder guru.
Right.
In our field.
She knows her stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She really does.
She's a non-diet registered dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor. She's an approved supervisor through the International Association for Eating Disorder Professions. And she works with individuals and families to help them recover from eating disorders. And Shauna has online training courses for dietitians and other healthcare providers to learn valuable tools for supporting the recovery of eating disorders, chronic dieting, and disordered eating.
Yeah, that's quite the resume.
Yeah, it's amazing the work she does. She's such a compassionate caregiver. And you can really tell.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. All right, well, let's get to Shauna, because this is a really interesting interview, and it definitely, I had my eyes opened. There's quite a few things in this interview that were like, wow, really? I didn't realize that. So yeah, give it a listen. And if you have any thoughts, let us know. Feel free to reach out and let us know your thoughts after you've heard everything that we have to say.
Hi, we're here with Shauna today, Shauna Melbourne, dietitian. Please, Shauna, we're so thrilled to have you today. I've been following you for over 2 decades as you are the eating disorder guru in the dietetics field. And I'm just so excited to talk to you today. Can you please introduce yourself and tell the listeners your background and what you do and who you help in your work?
For sure. Well, thank you, Sandra. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. To open up about myself, it's always a little bit nerve-wracking to try and talk about myself, but I will do my best here. I am Shauna Melbourne. I'm a registered dietitian. I'm also an approved supervisor through the International Association for Eating Disorder Professionals, and I'm also a certified intuitive eating counselor. But before all of that, I specialize in working with those living with eating disorders. So behind all of those credentials is really just my approach to working with people and their caregivers, parents, anybody who's living with an eating disorder, disordered eating. And my approach is really grounded in compassion. You know, when I think of like my overarching approach to eating disorders, it's really giving and kindness and compassion. So that's really what I operate on. And I've been doing this, like you had mentioned, Sandra, for like like 20 years. I've been out there working with individuals and families and teaching other healthcare providers as well as dietitians about eating disorder support and care. And like what you and I were just chatting about before we pressed record is that there are very limited resources out there for healthcare providers to learn about eating disorders. And so that has become really my mission over the last, say, 7 years or so, 6, 7 years, to educate other healthcare providers about eating disorders. And because I'm a dietitian, of course, I speak to and mostly teach other dietitians. And so I run a small private practice, but mostly I put my effort and my concentration into ED for RDs, and that stands for Eating Disorder Education for Registered Dietitians. So we've got all kinds of online programs and ways of learning and just recently growing and adding in different courses and different presenters and different types of courses and topics that are available for healthcare providers to learn about.
Oh, yeah, I love that. I've taken some of your courses and following you for so many years, and I know that you're the guru because I've seen your work and I follow you closely, and I just think you're such a resource to the community of dietitians and healthcare providers, and I really so appreciate you coming on to the show today. So that's awesome.
It is. It's really nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm guessing there's not a lot of dietitians who want to touch this subject, just because it's such a sensitive issue, and there's probably not a lot of resources out there. So it's puts more of a spotlight on you and what you're doing.
You're right that a lot of healthcare providers are, I think of it as being more worried and scared about not creating more harm. And I think as humans in general, if we don't really know a lot about something, we generally, you know, maybe we kind of stay away or we avoid it or we don't get ourselves involved because we don't really understand the workings and the mechanisms of whatever that might be. Totally. And the same thing happens with eating disorders. If we think of our schooling as healthcare providers, I know myself 20 years ago, well, more than 20 years ago, I only learned just the diagnostic criteria. That doesn't even begin to help us at all. And it doesn't help us as healthcare providers to help individuals. There is such a misunderstanding about eating disorders in general. And then there's, you know, opinions and, you know, it gets all just jumbled up basically. And what happens is that a lot of healthcare providers, they just don't want to get into eating disorders as a result, unfortunately. And that creates a huge lack of resources available for individuals to access care. But also, there's also a huge lack of access for training for healthcare providers, which has really been my mission behind ED for RDs, is to close that gap. I know that when I started in eating disorders 20 years ago, there was nothing. There was really not anything available out there for me to learn about eating disorders. And even I would try and approach other healthcare providers who were more seasoned and experienced than I was, and I was just told to refer out. And while that may have been accessible back then, it still didn't give me the tools and the tools to really be able to support individuals. So again, that's really the mission behind ED for RDs, is to also make sure that healthcare providers don't go without education, because unfortunately, again, because of lack of resources, we just can't refer out any longer. We do need to be there as healthcare providers to support those who are really struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, actually, I'm sure there's many listeners that, you know, tune in to our podcast here. And actually, one listener a few months ago had a question, and that's kind of the impetus for us to reach out to you and see if you wanted to come on, because I thought it'd be great to have the guru of eating disorders on here. And one of her questions, she had a few questions, but I mean, it is a common theme with many people, I think, in especially in the midst of this diet culture we live in with social media and everything. And I know eating disorder is, it's an illness. So it's just another, not just another illness, but it is an illness, and it has such a psychological component, and and it's so linked also with anxiety, depression, and all of those have just skyrocketed as we were talking about, like over the pandemic. You know, it's just people are isolated, and the rates of eating disorders, I think, have, as you said, have just shot through the roof. Yeah. And so, as you mentioned, there's hardly any resources. And so, you know, we wanted to be at least, you know, a way for people to, you know, if you look in the show notes, we'll have the information about Shauna's website for people to access more tools and resources and help for their eating disorder journey. But one of the questions that this listener had was, what are some ways to fight overeating binge cycles?
Well, I'm thankful for the show to be able to answer listeners' questions like this. I think if we went on Dr. Google, we would find all kinds of answers, but answers that a lot of them, unfortunately, could be rooted in diet culture and fat phobia and foodism, which leaves people feeling even more afraid of what is happening and not as helpful as what it could be. And, you know, aside from working with an eating disorder informed registered dietitian, not everybody has the access to do so. So again, I'm just really thankful that I can answer this question and provide your listeners with some things to think about. You know, when we think about moving from a place of restriction to an out of that, or perhaps moving, you know, the eating disorder may have shape shifted into more of a binge type experience, it can be really, really terrifying. It's very terrifying for that individual to experience that, and concerning for those people that are living around that human that is also struggling. And comments can be made, and you know, you're wondering, oh my gosh, is this turning into yet another eating disorder, or this is getting out of control? What do I do? I'm really terrified. I think firstly, it's really important for anybody to acknowledge just how they're feeling with this transition or the differences in how they're experiencing the food. Because as you mentioned, Sandra, we know that it's very much psychological. We know that eating disorders are about the food, yet it's so not about the food all at the same time. And that can be really confusing because here, you know, if somebody living with restrictive tendencies, like let's say it's anorexia, or something similar to that. And then, you know, there's a lot of, you know, that restriction, but there's a lot of that emotional avoidance. And the emotional avoidance can be manifested in how somebody relates to their food and body. And in this case, with restrictive tendencies, that the emotional avoidance or the emotional pain, the emotional discomfort is manifesting itself in the form of restriction. And so if the eating disorder itself starts shape shifting, sometimes what happens is that that person is now exposed to those really powerful and very terrifying and really upsetting and painful emotions. And so that feels really awful. It feels really awful. And so it can feel very scary, that person wanting and needing to find different ways of avoiding that emotion. And that makes sense to me because a lot of the emotions can feel just so painful and so uncomfortable. So I think, again, when I first talk about eating disorders, although I'm a dietitian, one would think that I would just talk all about food. And yes, I do. And also the premise of the eating disorder is also something that is just so important that we highlight and that we don't ignore that piece. And being an eating disorder dietitian, my role does tend to overlap with a therapist or a psychologist. I'm not a psychologist. Definitely not. And yet that overlap is just so important. So now I'll kind of go into maybe some of the practical reasons or maybe more tangible reasons why this shape shift or the difference in the experience can be happening.
Shauna, just before you go on, sorry, I just had a comment that I often say to clients that, you know, are battling with just the relationship with food. And it is you can stop drugs or stop alcohol or stop cigarettes, but with food, you cannot not eat. Like you have to eat. And so that's, you have to reconcile that relationship, and you have to find a way to do it so it's not so painful and uncomfortable and scary and terrifying, as you mentioned, all those emotions that go along with eating for someone living with an eating disorder.
You're so right. I mean, here we have somebody who could be absolutely terrified of eating, and yet, you know, part of treatment is eating and doing that absolutely terrifying thing 3 to 6 times a day. And you're right, somebody trying to stop smoking or stop drinking, avoidance is part of the treatment, yet it's very much the opposite in eating disorders.
Wow. Yes. Oh my gosh, that's interesting. Oh, just the way you frame that, it makes a lot of sense. 3 to 6 times a day. Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought of that.
Yeah. You know, sometimes in treatment, we have all different kinds of ways in which we may approach treatment. And sometimes our treatment, it is about exposure. And so it's exposure around food, exposure to body, exposure to terrifying foods. And we don't have that when you're trying to quit smoking or trying to quit drinking. There's exposure to perhaps the emotional side of a person's experience. But in eating disorders, it is also the exposure to emotions, but it's also exposure to food. So it's very difficult. It's very, very challenging for somebody to work through treatment. It's important and helpful, of course, and also really, really difficult.
Yeah.
I would think there's a lot of people with eating disorders that don't even realize they have an eating disorder.
You're right.
Do you find that?
I do find that. And
like probably also, more so than, say, someone who has a drinking problem, because it's, I don't know, I think those kind of issues, those kind of addictions might be a bit more recognized socially than an eating disorder.
With eating disorders, particularly when I think of restrictive tendencies, let's say we're talking about anorexia, it's very much applauded in our diet culture.
Yes.
And it's our normalized eating in our culture has become very abnormal. But the abnormal eating and dangerous eating is very normalized.
Right.
And so individuals may not even see that they are really challenged by eating enough food and feeling okay in their bodies and living with an eating disorder, disordered eating, and other people around that person may not even recognize it. And we know that only a very small percentage of people actually live in an emaciated, what one would view as an undernourished body.
Right.
And yet most people living with anorexia live in what one may deem, I'm using finger quotes here, like a normal size body.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's very difficult even for healthcare providers to detect somebody who is living with an eating disorder as well because of that stigma, that incredibly harmful stigma.
And there's so many people, like so many clients that I have had that come to me who want to lose weight in quotes, and they've been on every diet under the sun, the keto diet, the intermittent fasting, all the different diets. And underneath all of that, it's not about the diet. It's about their own body acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about wanting to control their weight and their body shape and size with restrictive eating. Now, is that similar to an eating disorder, or is that a different thing?
I like to think of eating disorders and disordered eating as though it's on a spectrum. And there's a cutoff or a cusp, I guess a cusp and a cutoff, in which it flips into a diagnosed eating disorder. And really what differentiates a diagnosed eating disorder and a disordered eating is the intensity and the frequency of engaging in symptoms, as what we call. So the behaviors that are associated with the eating disorder itself. And you know, what also affects this is access to care. Here in Canada, we don't need a diagnosis in order to receive care. yet a diagnosis can be incredibly helpful for some people. It's not always helpful for everybody, but can be incredibly helpful for some people to receive that diagnosis, to finally feel like, oh my gosh, finally somebody recognizes that this is a problem. And therefore, almost gives that person the permission to seek the help and support that they need.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, that's so interesting. I know the diagnosis helps because now they're in the system and they're getting referrals, but then it doesn't always mean there's resources for that. Like, it's just, even though they get referred, it doesn't automatically mean there is someone sitting in a chair that can help. And right. That's why I'm so glad that your services are available online to help teach dietitians and to give tools to the health professionals and to clients too, because it's just, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's, this is, wow. What a powerful interview, eh, Rob? Oh my gosh. So much information. For
sure. Yeah. Great. Okay. So building on the emotional response to how that person is feeling, emotional avoidance, perhaps the shape shifting of their experience. You know, if we were to think of like a triangle almost, you know, if we talk about the premise, just how that person is feeling and what's going on emotionally, then the next step up from that, maybe some of these more tangible ways in which we may approach it. So just some questions and perhaps some thoughts that I like to bring into session with clients when we start exploring what could be going on, because there's never just like a one a one road, one answer kind of thing. I always say to, you know, dietitians that I'm working with, I wish that there was a flow chart. Wouldn't that be so lovely, right? We could just like turn to page 12 and there would be a flow chart. Unfortunately, such is not the case. So what I like to do when I'm working with an individual is spend a lot of time exploring and figuring it out together. I am not the expert in somebody's life or their body or their food. And so I want to collaborate with that individual as much and as often as I possibly can.
It's the way it should be, like right across the board in healthcare, don't you think?
I do.
I mean, I would not like someone telling me what I'm feeling and what I need to do. You know, I need to be part of that solution. I think that's amazing that you've recognized that.
And I think one of the misconceptions, I mean, it is a part misconception, part truth to it, is that when somebody is so undernourished, when the brain has shrunk because of undernourishment, it can be very difficult for that individual to make really good, sound decisions towards their well-being. And in holding that, the other dichotomous thought that I like to hold on to at the same time is knowing that this person is still a human with loves and a future and a past and a name and a sibling and has passions and still knows themselves. So I like to hold both of these approaches in the air all at the same time while I'm working with somebody. And so one of the things that I like to explore with somebody who is struggling from, you know, living with restrictive tendencies and now experiencing more binge or overeating, you know, what one may call overeating. You know, the first question that I say to, you know, the statement overeating, overeating what from what? Like, who is that this person, whoever this person is, that sets the, you know, the cutoff point as though that there's a cutoff point that if you eat over and above this amount, it's called overeating. And if you eat, you know, this way, then it's not. So I like to explore that with people, like just explore these words that we are so used to using. And just what one thing that I also really like to do is just flip these words on their head and just think, okay, well, would another area of healthcare use similar words in their, you know, ways in working with their diagnosed clients, you know, just sort of like taking it out of the context of eating and using it in a different way. And so overeating is a word that, you know, very much is come from diet culture, as though that there's a limit in which we should eat or not eat. So I like exploring these kinds of words. I'm kind of like a language nut when it comes to these types of things.
That's a smart approach.
One of the things that, again, I like to explore is, could this be the body's way of saying, let's eat, right? Like, let's eat. I am hungry. Let's eat. And could it be could it signify, right, the shape-shifting experience, could it signify that this person may have healed or done some healing in their emotional avoidance, i.e. the restriction, and therefore there's room to start eating? And could it be that now that this person has started to eat, it may feel as though that it's, I'll use finger quotes here, overeating or binging, but rather it could be this person finding the permission to actually feed their body.
In a normal way.
And it can feel really scary. It can feel very frightening. It can leave a person feeling as though that they're out of control, and yet it might not be. So that's something that I don't have the answers to, whether it's the feeling or the emotional avoidance or, you know, going from anorexia to binge eating. I don't know. But what I do know is that, hey, there's a lot of questions here. And let's get to know the experience a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's huge.
When I think of binge eating, somebody experiencing binge eating, I like to kind of talk about the two main reasons why somebody engages in binging. And of course, there are 9 million reasons. So I'm not just boiling it down to only two main. But the overarching reasons could be, number one, physical hunger. So that physical drive towards food. And number two is the emotional response to how that person is experiencing their environment and themselves and their life, etc., their past experiences as well.
Right.
The physical drive towards food doesn't always mean that the person will feel the typical hunger cues like, oh, my stomach is growling. I feel lightheaded. You know, some people can actually feel just that physical drive towards food. And there's no other physical sensations that come alongside of it other than I need to eat food. And so when somebody has been restricting for, you know, a chunk of time, it can create some fractures in being able to fully be aware and listening to that physical drive towards food. And so whatever creates that physical drive towards food, right? Maybe it could be emotional healing. Maybe it could be just the shape shifting of the eating disorder itself. Maybe there could be other experiences that cause the shift. And that physical drive towards food can feel as though that it's the binge. Or it could meet the clinical definition of binging.
Right.
And so the questions that I ask around this to somebody and like to explore is, are you eating enough during the day? Right. Just that question, what is it like for you to eat during the day? Tell me about how you eat from the time that you get up out of bed to the time that you go to bed. And when I'm talking to somebody about how they're eating, I'm just imagining, okay, if I were to eat like that during the day, or if somebody else I knew were to eat that way during the day, how would that leave them feeling? Because I don't know exactly how much somebody is supposed to eat during the day, but you kind of get a general clue or general idea of just how their bodies are, how the person's body and emotional self and concentration levels and, you know, all these things kind of work throughout the day. So I really like to start with that question. And then I'm just kind of thinking, I wonder what it would be like if this person were to eat a little bit more during the day, or with more balance during the day, or even with more variety during the day, if that's successful for the person. On the other hand, somebody could actually be eating enough food, enough nourishment, enough nutrition during the day, but certain foods are restricted. That person may be avoiding carbohydrates, or they might be avoiding fat, or they might be avoiding desserts, or however you want to label, you know, different categories of food. They might be restricting these kinds of foods. And what happens is that really increases the emotional charge towards these foods. And that can really ignite the need to engage in a binge, right? The avoidance equals attraction.
Totally. Right. Yeah. It's like the elephant in the room, right?
If right.
if you say you can't have it, then you really want it. And I've seen that a lot in the last decade with carbs and bread and pasta. And, you know, many people are just like, nope, I can't eat those. And then that's when they're feeling tired or low in the day. That's what they go for, because they've said to themselves, they can't have it. So we're human. We treat ourselves. We want to have, and then the whole guilt and repent and repeat kind of cycle.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, that oh, that self-talk can be so negative, and that perpetuates, you know, the next cycle of binging. Oh, it just, you know, people can really end up in this a vicious emotional cycle that can be broken and can be healed. And it can be very, very terrifying for some people to experience this.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I also explore just, you know, people's experience with eating overall, one of the things that I really include is the history of what food was like for that person growing up. Not only what is it like for you right now, but what has it been for you growing up? Our past experiences really matter. And mm-hmm. how a person was treated with food, maybe they were punished with food or withheld food, the food messages that were in the home, food messages that were not in the home, whether the person was put on a diet when they were really young or told that their body wasn't good enough because it wasn't a certain body weight, shape, or size that was quote unquote acceptable. You know, all of these things really, really matter to how the person is currently experiencing food as well, whether it's restriction or binging or another presentation of an eating disorder, disordered eating.
So many things that can trigger that, hey? So many experiences in our life, like you mentioned. I mean, the list is almost endless. And mm-hmm. and you can see it, like Sandra points out so many times, different scenarios, and it's like that's going to create an eating disorder if that situation keeps happening, you know. And it's like, yeah, it's crazy how many different things are out there like that, different behaviors and different, you know, dynamics
messages
within families. And yeah, it's crazy. Mm-hmm.
It really is. Yeah. And we also know too that eating disorders don't begin from just one reason. Mm-hmm. There's a multitude. We call it the perfect storm.
Yeah,
that people can be predisposed to developing an eating disorder. We know that there is a genetic factor to developing an eating disorder.
Oh, really?
Nature versus nurture. Yeah. Well, there's twin studies that have been conducted. And so we know that there is a genetic component. We also know that there's also a genetic component, nurture versus nature, with regards to anxiety, depression, other mood disorders, learning disabilities, etc. And that can also predispose a person for developing an eating disorder in the future. It doesn't mean that it will happen, not at all, because there's also gene expression that gets thrown in the mix as well. But we do know that it's multifactorial, and there's never, ever just one reason why.
Interesting.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Jeez. Okay. The second question, this might blend into the first question, but how to learn how to eat and trust myself, what to eat so I don't fall into the cycle of calorie counting and binge eating was the second question from our listener.
Yeah, great question. Well, there's lots of ways in which we could approach this, if I were in a session with a person who asked me this question, I think that there would be many, many different areas in which I think I would be inclined to approach this. One of which is, what is the function of calorie counting? What would be the function of tracking food? What is the function of the eating disorder? What's the function of dieting? What is the function, right? What purpose would calorie counting play in a person's life?
I love that. That's a great way to, that's a good thing to ask yourself always. If this is,
it really is
something that, yeah.
All these things we've learned and have been told all our life, but no one's ever questioned why we're doing them. Don't we all count calories? Isn't that what we have to do and measure our food? Doesn't everyone do that? That's what they say everywhere.
That's what they say everywhere. We're so exposed to all kinds of ideas when it comes to managing our food intake and what we have to do. And yet just starting with, what's the function? We get to really explore perhaps the emotional attachment to calorie counting, but also dispel myths around calorie counting, because we don't eat calories. We eat food. Mm-hmm. And so exploring that myth, how we eat and the function. And, you know, the other thing that I like to bring into the mix here too is, what kind of protection does the eating disorder play in a person's life? Or what kind of protection does calorie counting provide to a person? It may be a maladaptive protective mechanism. And also, could there still be a protective mechanism that this eating disorder plays in a person's life?
Right. You're just kind of trying to recognize what purpose that serves, right?
Absolutely. What is the purpose? When we have a better understanding of the purpose, then just like understanding eating disorders, then we tend to be not as afraid of certain things and we get to understand it a bit better and we can give it less power. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I really like to dive into and explore with people. What's the function? What's the purpose? How protective is this behavior for you? Then together we get to decide what we're going to do with it. Somebody isn't going to go from one day counting calories to the next day not counting calories, because these are thoughts, these are experiences that are running around in this person's brain. And if it provides a certain mechanism, a protective mechanism, we're just not going to get rid of the calorie counting overnight. But what we can do is recognize it and provide it with less power.
Absolutely.
And by doing that, you know, I kind of think of it as like displacement. You know, if I'm thinking about counting the calories in my food, then that occupies a certain space in my brain, and it therefore provides less space in my brain to think about how painful it is to do A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or how emotionally disruptive it is for me to feel C, D, and E. So I think of it as like a displacement. So if I'm working with somebody and we figure out, you know, some ways in which they may feel comfortable to decrease their calorie counting behavior, then what does that expose them to? It could expose them to their painful, dysregulating emotion. So we need to have tools for that. We need to have a really good therapist on board to help that person with this emotional dysregulation, right? We can't just take away calorie counting and think that that's the end of it. No, there needs to be like a pairing of other coping mechanisms and tools for this person to use instead of the calorie counting.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach. And I think you're right. The recognizing and acknowledging the why is the first really big step. And then that just starts the ball rolling, you know? And that can be the case across the board. I talk to people a lot of times. For some reason, people come to me when they have problems. They think I have the solutions or I'm just a good listener. I don't know. But I always ask why. And it's amazing how many times people have never gone past that first stage. You know, it's right. Like, oh, I feel this certain way. And I'm like, why do you think you feel that way? And they're like, I don't know. And, you know, and then it makes them dig a little deeper, and then they eventually find the answers they're looking for just by asking that question, why? Mm-hmm. And it's the same in this situation. It's, you know, why am I counting calories? Why do I feel the need to do whatever action I'm doing, you know, regarding food? And it's amazing how empowering that can be, having that knowledge, just that one little bit of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And empowering is such a big piece to working with somebody living with an eating disorder, disordered eating. It's providing that power back to them. Trust is a huge component to eating disorder recovery and finding trust, whether it's trust within themselves, trust with another human, trust with their food, trust with their bodies. Building that trust is a huge, huge component. So that's something that I really like to build into sessions with the people that I work with, is building that trust. You know, when I think of, okay, this could be the premise in which we may explore the calorie counting, and then, you know, the next level up from this could be more tangible, you know, practical kind of suggestions. And one of the things that I've worked on with clients is, when you find yourself calorie counting, could that be a clue to you that, oh, okay, there's that calorie counting again. Now I'm going to start thinking about horses, or now I'm going to start to think about my dog, or now I'm going to start to think about just something that may bring joy or a smile or just something completely opposite than calorie counting, to help that person to just, you know, switch gears and to, you know, acknowledge, oh, yep, okay, there's that calorie thing again, and then switch gears and start thinking about something else.
Perfect.
It's not going to automatically turn off the calorie counting, but it can be something just, it's non-judgmental. It's just a really, can be a bit of a game too sometimes for people that, oh yeah, there's that calorie counting thing. and not to, you know, berate themselves or, you know, shame themselves or guilt themselves when they do notice calorie counting. But let's switch gears and just start to think about something that may bring a smile to your face.
Oh, I love that. It's kind of like a trigger, like to have an image as it like
a positive trigger.
You realize. Yeah. You realize like you're starting to calorie count, or you're starting to have those, you're going down that path of restriction or thinking about food in a certain way. And then if you've talked to someone about this and identified that that's something that you're doing and you don't want to do it anymore, but it's taking so much of your energy and brain because you've been doing it for so many years, that to have a trigger like that, like you said, think of your dog or think of your cottage or somewhere that brings you peace and joy. And then it can be a way to, you know, distraction and then also transition. So the more you do that, then the more like you're having better thoughts. And then also you're getting away from that kind of calorie counting and restriction kind of thinking.
Absolutely.
And like you said too before, it occupies less space in your brain if you're if you're sort of changing the image of what's going on in there. It reduces the amount of space that those negative images take up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Also, patience is a really important component to all of this. Patience for the healthcare provider that's working with individuals who are engaging in any kind of eating disorder, disordered eating behaviors, is that it's a journey in and of itself. That there are so many journeys that are involved in treatment and working through the throes of disordered eating and an eating disorder, that patience is something that it's hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how can we hold on to the patience with ourselves and for the people that we're working with?
Yeah.
It's so important.
Quick question about kind of, I don't want to say success rate, but as far as I'm guessing it's kind of like you said, a sliding scale or a spectrum with how people heal. Is this something that they get to a point where they're good to go? Or is it something they're always going to have to deal with and they're just learning tools with how to cope with their eating disorder or behavior? Or how does that work?
This is one of my most favorite topics. And I think why it's so one of my favorites is because it's so, we have a very traditional approach to what we deem as recovery. And I am all about turning our traditional approaches on its head.
Perfect.
And just really asking a lot of questions. There are some, of course, incredible traditional ways in which we approach eating disorders. And there's ways in which there's lots of questions and not enough answers. Mm-hmm. And the way that recovery has been deemed or defined historically is that there are zero body image hangups and zero food hangups. And for some people, they do land in this place of what researchers deem, our clinicians deem, as complete recovery. And some people do land there and they will never look back. And there are other people that they don't land in this complete place of like zero body image hangups and zero food hangups. And to me, that's really understandable given the diet culture that we live in and how difficult it is for us to remove ourselves from that kind of talk and environment. And to me, this is the people that I have so much compassion for and how difficult it is to sit in this space, knowing that researchers or clinicians have this kind of, you know, definition kind of hanging out here, and they may not feel like they could get there, or maybe it's not for them, or, you know, just their experience is just not, it's just not accessible for them. So I really like to redefine recovery. And I don't do it for that person, but rather we work on it together. And what does recovery look like for that person? Abstinence, complete abstinence from eating disorder thoughts and behaviors, that doesn't have to happen in order for a person to live a full life that matches and resembles their morals and values, right? So I think what is so critical is that we really take a really good look at our binary language that we use when we think about either you're recovered or you're not.
Yeah.
Right. So we don't have to be recovered or not. We can still be in recovery. Maybe that's the language that really resonates for a person, or perhaps they are building capacity towards a life that matches or resembles their morals and values. Mm-hmm. And so I like to describe it that way because it leaves a lot of openness and it's not a defined place, but rather it's a journey. Like this is where we're going and this is where we're heading. And it helps that person to live a life that feels very meaningful for them. And it may include some eating disorder thoughts and behaviors, or maybe it doesn't.
Because it could totally be an unattainable goal. I mean, just to get that black and white, no thoughts of anything that has to do with the eating disorder anymore. Because our brain is, our thoughts are constant, right? So, and especially if you have been thinking a certain way for years, day after day, 200, 300 times a day, to like eradicate that little highway in the brain is really difficult.
Very difficult. Very difficult. And I think when we have this kind of black and white language, like you're recovered or you're not, it leaves so much room for shame and guilt and burnout as well. Mm-hmm. And full recovery is possible. So when we think of, this black and white language, it doesn't mean that I don't believe in full recovery. In fact, I hold hope for full recovery for everybody that I work with. Mm-hmm. And also, full recovery doesn't mean that that's the end goal.
Right.
But rather, recovery for that individual is defined on an individual basis.
Mm-hmm. Their version is different than someone else's kind of end goal, right?
Yes. Yeah, yes.
That makes sense. That's a good way to approach it for sure.
This has been like super interesting and comprehensive interview. And we like to ask a question of all our guests that it brings us back to a little bit more about you. And so I say, if you're going to a potluck dinner, what dish would you bring? We're getting a bit, bit more lighthearted here.
I'm switching gears. Oh my God. That's actually something that I really struggle with because I just have so many ideas of all the food that I would like love to bring. I'm going to go with what I had for lunch today. And I had made sag paneer for a supper on the weekend, and it turned out so delicious. It was like just the best sag paneer that I have made. I've been trying to, I've been making sag paneer for like the last, year or two, and trying to tweak it and trying to perfect it, maybe not perfect it, but just make it like really, really delicious. And I think I hit the nail on the head this past weekend. So I think that this is my new recipe, my new creation that I would love to share with other people. So yes, if you're inviting me over for a potluck, you can expect sag paneer.
Do you know what? Yeah. I have no idea what that is.
The dish?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cultural dish. And it is made from spinach and radish greens. It does call for fenugreek, but I haven't found a place where I can find fenugreek that's not dried around here in Ottawa. And it has cubes of paneer in it. What and it has paneer? Mustard oil in it. And what else does it have?
What's paneer?
Paneer is like, it's a hard cheese.
Oh, okay.
And you can buy it in a brick and you cube it. And you fry it. And so part of the recipe is this fried cheese that's in cubes, and it's delicious.
Oh, say no more. I'm
in. I think Rob's going to start making this. This is awesome. Thank you. That's one way I ask.
Is it like a salad then? Is that kind of like with all the greens and stuff in there? It sounds kind of salad-y.
Oh, yeah. No, it's it is a warm, hot dish, and you create like – so all the greens are whizzed up together, so it's all – blendered.
Okay.
So it's like a puree of all of these cooked greens.
Right. Interesting.
Wow. Hey, Rob, you want to get the food processor out? Sorry.
Yeah.
That
no
sounds
doubt.
Delicious.
Yeah, it really is.
I can picture it. I've probably eaten it. I think where I've seen it before is in like one of the toppings in an Indian kind of buffet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's green, like this
browny
green color with these white cubes. But when you taste it, it is just, it's delicious.
Wow. And you had that for lunch?
Sounds so good.
That's amazing.
I had it for lunch. It was leftovers from the weekend. Yeah.
Right on.
Can you air fry it, I wonder, like for the cheese?
Probably you could. Oh. Probably you could. I like the traditional frying in oil because it doesn't, I find air fryers can kind of dry it out a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
I've put, have I done halloumi? No, I've done tofu in the air fryer. And I thought, oh, you know, it'll still be like nice and mushy in the inside. I like it like crusty on the outside, mushy on the inside. And it wasn't that. It was just like dried up pebbles of tofu.
Yeah, that's, it's a tricky one for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, that was, that's so awesome. Wow. That was like such a good interview and so much good information. Like it was just, wow. Hey, Rob, is your mind blown?
Oh, yeah. There's just, I could talk to you for another hour. There's just so many more things to, I kind of have a psychology background. So when we have these interviews that have that sort of psychology twist to it, I get, I mean, my wheels start turning and there's, like I said, we could go in that direction for a while, but yeah, it's fascinating just what we've heard so far. So thank you. Yeah.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me on this podcast. You know, this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and I really appreciate being able to get some messages out there and help any of your listeners, anybody who may be listening to this call, that help is available. And yeah, I'm really thankful that you asked me to come and chat today.
No, for sure.
Well, you can tell your like passion exudes through the microphone. Like you can see that you're so knowledgeable and passionate about helping people and empathetic about what's going on for them, because it's got so many connotations in our society. So it's really nice to talk to someone who actually, you know, has the compassion and can actually put themselves in their shoes and really speak the language of what's going on for people. Like it's just, it makes a huge difference.
It does. It does. It's such a complicated experience living with an eating disorder, disordered eating. And it, as we mentioned, you know, it can be just so difficult to receive, to get the care. And, you know, what I also say too, that it has to be the right care because not all approaches resonate with all people, right? Finding the different types of treatments and care and people and healthcare providers out there, that is also so important to find a matching system of care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that.
Absolutely.
Because there's, like you said, there's so many different sources of where this issue came from that, you know, you kind of have to treat it from where it evolved in a way, right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely.
Crazy.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much, Shauna. I really appreciate you coming on the show today. And all the links will be in the show notes for the listeners. And we'll have your resources, like your website and Instagram and Facebook, like the social media handles and all of the links so that the listeners can get more information if they want to look into it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rob and Sandra. I've really enjoyed today.
Thanks. Yeah, we appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much. Wow, Shauna is such a compassionate caregiver, and you can tell how much she cares about her clients and families and the pioneering work that she is doing with teaching dietitians and other healthcare professionals about how to work and help support people living with eating disorders.
Yeah, it really came through. And just in listening to her voice, you could tell how much compassion she had. And it's so nice to have that kind of person working with these people that need that kind of
empathy and just non-judgmental approach to the situation, because it is such a
delicate. It's a delicate situation, right? And
it's so personal and so people are so vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what part really stood out for me that I was just like, wow, I never thought of that. And both of you guys sort of mentioned it, is when you said, you know, with other addictions like drinking or smoking, you just can put it behind you and it's something you're trying to get away from. Whereas with food, and food's the trigger, you still have to eat. You still got to feed yourself 3-4 times a day, right? So you're dealing with this thing that's a huge trigger for you, but you still have to figure out a way around it. So it's like, wow, that's totally, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just that learning to live and have some sort of relationship with food because we need it for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, that was really enlightening. And it was so incredible about all the work she's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she, you can tell she's very passionate about what she does. And like I said, it's amazing when the right people step up into the right places and, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was good. And hopefully we will get her back on the show with other questions that we could just talk to her for endless.
Yeah, I'm sure. It was almost an hour. I still had things I wanted to ask. So yeah, we'll definitely get her on again. Well, hopefully that was helpful for anyone who's dealing with that sort of thing. And if you have questions, feel free to reach out to us. You can reach us through our email at mywifetherd@gmail.com. You can also connect with us through our social media pages. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can leave us a message there. Give us a like while you're there. You can give us a review too. I just realized we had a review page on Facebook. So if you feel like dropping a few words on there, feel free. That would be amazing. And we also have a website, don't we, Sandra?
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. We got a website. It's called mywifethedietitian.com.
And we got the podcast player right on the podcast link on the website.
Yeah.
Like on that tab.
It's a little new addition there to the podcast page. So you can just listen to the podcast right on the page if you want.
Yeah. And there's new articles.
All the time. But there are a couple new ones up or coming up or, yeah. So we will be back on Wednesday with Nutrition Nuggets, and we've got a special holiday health hacks for you. It's sort of how to navigate those holiday parties and how not to eat all the treats.
To enjoy them.
That's a better way to say it. How to enjoy them.
Yeah, and not totally go off the rails with your healthy lifestyle.
Exactly. So that'll be a fun one. That's Wednesday. So yeah, be sure to join us for that. And yeah, in the meantime, have a great week, everyone. We will talk to you Wednesday. Thanks for joining us today on My Wife the Dietitian. If you like what you heard, don't be shy. Leave us a comment or review and be sure to share our podcast with your friends. If you'd like to hear more, hit that subscribe button. You can also follow us on our social media pages for updates, episode trailers, and other odds and ends. For more info and links on what we discussed on today's episode, check the show notes. We'll be back next week with another informative and fun-filled episode.